A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's really Hannah's question, filtered through him. They've been driving through Ashdod and Modi'an, these Israeli cities of a couple hundred thousand people, and the feeling they both get is not physically empty, obviously. Like someone copy-pasted buildings from The Sims and forgot to add the part that makes a place feel like a place. And the puzzle is, why? Small towns in Ireland and villages in Greece and Spain manage to have character and charm with a fraction of the population. So what's tugging at him when Ashdod feels so let down? Is it the climate?
This is the exact question I love, because the numbers do say Ashdod should work. 225,000 people, a deepwater port, a coastline, a history stretching back to the Philistines. On a spreadsheet, it's a major city. This is one of those prompts where the question itself is doing a lot of work before you even answer it. Because the phrase hard to articulate shows up twice, and I think that's actually the core of it.
A parking lot with tall buildings is my new band name.
Here's the thing. When Daniel talks about that feeling of emptiness, he's not being poetic. There's a specific planning pathology at work. And I want to start by validating the feeling, because it's not just subjective aesthetic preference. There's a real phenomenon here. Ashdod has about 225,000 people. Modi'an is around 100,000. These are substantial populations. By global standards, a city of 200,000 is a proper city. It should have texture, identity, a sense of itself.
The emptiness was designed in from day one.
It's not just Ashdod. Israel built roughly 30 development towns between the 1950s and 70s, and most share this DNA. They were built fast to absorb immigrants. The goal was housing units per year, not urban quality. Aryeh Sharon, the architect who designed Israel's first national master plan, was a Bauhaus-trained modernist. He applied those principles to an entire country, separate functions, tower blocks in open space, wide roads.
The Bauhaus to Beige pipeline.
The climate argument that Hannah apparently gets back. You can't import European planning to a hot Middle Eastern environment is only about 20% right. Too big to feel intimate, too barren to feel welcoming, and in August they're blast furnaces.
When Daniel says you can't import European planning to a hot Middle Eastern environment, he's partly right, but for the wrong reason. The problem isn't that European planning doesn't work in the heat. It's that Israel imported the wrong European planning.
Israel imported Northern European modernism. Le Corbusier, the Radiant City, towers and parks, but the places Daniel is comparing Ashdod to, Greek villages, Spanish hill towns, those weren't planned by modernists. They grew organically over centuries. Ashdod was founded in 1956 as a development town, part of the big population dispersal effort after statehood. The goal was, get people onto the land fast. Build housing, build infrastructure, absorb immigrants.
Which Greece and Spain share.
The same philosophy that produced the French banlieues and British new towns, except in Israel, it was overlaid with an additional urgency because the state was absorbing massive waves of immigration and needed roofs over heads immediately. That's not European planning, as some alien import. That's Mediterranean common sense. Israel had that too. The old neighborhoods of Jaffa, the alleyways of Jerusalem's old city, the stone villages of the Galilee, all the knowledge was there. And Modi'an is a different generation but the same DNA. It was planned in the 1990s as a new commuter city between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, designed by the architect Moshe Safdi, who, by the way, is a major figure, designed Habitat 67 in Montreal, a genuine visionary.
It's like throwing out your air conditioner. Because the future is heat lamps.
Then being confused about why everyone's uncomfortable. But let me give you a more specific mechanism. There's a researcher named Jan Gehl who's done incredible work on what makes public spaces feel alive. Because what got built and what was planned diverged dramatically. The execution phase got handed to contractors who maximized density within each plot, value engineered away the public spaces, and produced what you see now. rows of identical limestone-clad apartment blocks on hillsides connected by wide arterial roads, with commercial activity concentrated in malls and big-box retail.
Whereas in Ashdod, the building is in the middle of a sea of nothing.
The tower sits in an undefined expanse. There's no street wall, no edge, no transition. You step out of your lobby into an open ground doesn't invite lingering. It invites walking across it quickly to get to somewhere else.
The entire city is designed as a place you're supposed to leave.
And the result is a housing storage facility. Every element of the design says this is not a destination. Wide arterial roads say drive-through. Setback buildings say don't get close. Lack of street-level retail says nothing to see here. The public realm is a corridor, not a place.
That's the difference with Connachilty. Daniel mentioned it, small town in West Cork, maybe 5,000 people. The streets are narrow, buildings are different heights and colors, pushed right up to the pavement. A pub next to a bakery, next to a bookshop. Every 20 meters, there's something new to look at.
By any objective measure, this should be one of the most interesting cities in the country. A lively street in Copenhagen might have 15 to 20 soft edges per 100 meters. A typical Ashdod residential block might have one. The lobby door. Everything else is blank wall or parking entrance.
One soft edge per 100 meters. That's not a city. That's a warehouse district.
No street wall, no consistent setback, no rhythm of facade and void. Just buildings placed on plots, each doing its own thing, with parking lots and gaps in between. Researchers call it visual complexity or information richness. A traditional street gives you constant small variations, materials, colors, shadows, shines, plants, people. There's a planning concept that explains exactly this. It's called the figure-ground relationship.
The brain checks out. It's the architectural equivalent of a screensaver.
In Ashdod and Modian, that relationship is inverted. Buildings are objects floating in space, and the space between them is just left over, undefined, unshaped, not designed for human use. You can drive for 10 minutes and nothing has changed except the number on the building.
Which brings us to Modian. Same problem, but the version they built in the 90s and 2000s.
Modian is fascinating because it was supposed to be different. It was planned in the 1990s as a new city halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. First, the street section. In a Greek island village, the street is narrow, often 3 to 5 meters wide. The buildings are 2 to 3 stories, directly abutting the street, with doors and windows opening onto it. The proportion of building height to street width creates what planners call enclosure. The street feels like an outdoor room. Your eye has somewhere to land. In Ashdod, the street is 25 to 30 meters wide, the buildings are set back behind parking or landscaping, and you're left in a no-man's land where nothing defines the space. Second, the construction industry is dominated by a handful of large contractors who optimize for speed and cost. They have catalogs of approved building types. You pick from the catalog. Variations cost money.
Build me a city nobody notices they're living in.
The Greek villages didn't stumble into narrow streets because they didn't know how to build wider ones. They built what worked for human beings on foot in a Mediterranean climate. They care about square meters and projected value, not whether the street will be pleasant to walk down. The developer optimizes for the buyer, and the buyer isn't there for the street life.
The entire incentive structure is aligned against charm.
This does two things. It puts daily life on the street. There are always people coming and going, transactions happening, social encounters, and it means the economic life of the place is distributed, granular, human-scaled. In Ashdod and Modian, commercial is concentrated in malls and power centers. You drive to a parking lot, you enter a climate-controlled box, you transact, you leave. The street is dead because nothing happens on it.
The mall is the anti-stoop.
It really is. And this is not a climate argument because the mall is air-conditioned and the street is hot. But that's circular. The street is hot because it's 30 meters wide with no shade. You solve the climate problem with narrow streets, arcades, planting, and building materials with thermal mass. You don't solve it by moving life indoors and surrendering the public realm to cars.
The climate argument that Daniel's been making to Hannah, that you can't import European planning, it's actually the opposite.
The short answer is continuity. Greek island villages weren't master planned by a central authority. They grew incrementally over centuries with each generation adding and adapting. Third factor, materiality and craft. In a Greek village, the buildings are whitewashed, the stone is local, the woodwork is painted in specific colors that have evolved over centuries.
Evolution versus intelligent design, and evolution won.
Jerusalem stone facing if you're lucky, stucco if you're not, curtain wall if it's an office building. There's no shared material vocabulary, so nothing holds together visually. The buildings are 2 to 3 stories, whitewashed with flat roofs. The white reflects heat. The narrow streets create continuous shade for most of the day. Fourth factor, incremental development over time. This is the big one. Those Greek and Spanish villages weren't master planned. They grew organically over centuries.
None of this was in the building code. It was just what worked.
That layering creates complexity and surprise. What Christopher Alexander called the quality without a name. You can't plan it, but you can create conditions where it can happen. The Spanish hill towns do something similar with different materials. In Andalusia, you get narrow streets, white walls, but also interior courtyards with fountains. But here's the thing. This doesn't mean new cities are doomed to soullessness. There are counterexamples.
The courtyard is essentially a natural air conditioner. Zero energy, zero moving parts, working for 1,000 years. And this is what drives me crazy about the Israeli planning conversation. The knowledge is sitting right there, across the Mediterranean. The climate is similar. The materials are available. But instead, we got tower blocks with air conditioning units bolted to every wall.
The air conditioner is the crutch that enables bad design. If you know every unit will have mechanical cooling, you don't have to think about orientation, cross-ventilation, thermal mass, or shading. And that brings me to the fifth factor, which is the one I think is most specifically Israeli, the development town legacy and the centralized land system.
In a country where summer temperatures hit 40 degrees and the grid is under constant strain, that's not just an aesthetic problem, it's a resilience problem.
This creates a system where large tracts are tendered as packages, won by a small number of major developers and built out as uniform projects. There's no fine-grained ownership. No small builders adding one building at a time, no organic evolution of the urban fabric.
It's a structural problem. The land regime itself prevents the kind of granular development that creates character. You're not going to linger in a plaza when every air conditioner is dumping waste heat into it.
It was trying to house hundreds of thousands of people, fast, on a budget. The aesthetic and experiential quality of the resulting cities was simply not a design parameter. It's a doom loop.
The charming places have the opposite loop. Good urban form creates peasant microclimate, which draws people outside, which activates the public realm, which makes people love the place, which leads to care and investment, which makes it even better.
In a Greek village, the physical form and the social life are in dialogue. The plaza hosts the evening paseo. The narrow street hosts the neighbor's conversation. The stoop hosts the grandmother's watchful eye.
Let's talk about scale. Daniel mentions Ashdod has over 200,000 people, and at that size, a city should have some kind of culture, some kind of identity. That's the size of Bordeaux, of Aberdeen, of Richmond, Virginia. That's a really useful distinction. It's not that nothing is happening. It's that the city isn't telling you anything is happening.
The reason they do is that they weren't built all at once. Bordeaux grew over 2,000 years. Every century left a layer. The Roman grid, the medieval walls, the 18th century boulevards, the modern tram system. The city is a palimpsest. Let me pick up on something Daniel mentioned about Ireland, Clonakilty specifically. Population about 5,000. And he's right, it has vastly more character than Ashdod, it's not just age.
One set of assumptions.
It has a material palette, painted render, slate roofs, timber shop fronts, that's consistent without being uniform. It has a public realm, the street, the square, the waterfront, that's shaped and defined by buildings. And it grew incrementally, so there's variety within the coherence.
Every one of those things is a specific, replicable design choice. None of them are be old or be Irish.
And that's the hopeful part of this conversation. None of what makes Clonakilty charming is magic. It's a set of urban design principles that are well understood and could be applied to new development. They just aren't being applied in Israel at scale.
What would it take? If you were handed a blank site in Israel tomorrow and told to build a new neighborhood that wouldn't feel like Ashdod, what would you do differently?
Narrow streets, maximum 15 meters for residential, 20 for mixed-use arterials. Buildings built to the property line, forming a continuous street wall. Ground floor commercial required on designated main streets with residential above. A maximum block size that ensures walkability, something like 80 by 120 meters, not the super blocks you see in Modian.
The wide arterial roads. Once they're in, they're never coming out.
And critically, parcel the land into small lots and sell them to multiple developers and individual builders, not to one mega developer. It cuts the city into pieces and makes crossing it an ordeal. Ashdod is full of these. They're the skeleton of the city, and the skeleton is hostile to human life.
There's a specific detail I want to pull out. The train station is nowhere near the beach. It's surrounded by parking lots. So even the one piece of infrastructure that should connect people to the waterfront fails to do it.
Breaking that would require a policy intervention, requiring that a percentage of lots in any new development be sold individually, or creating a mechanism for small builders to participate in tenders. It's not technically impossible, it's politically difficult. The city took its one irreplaceable natural amenity and designed the transportation system to ignore it.
It's like building a ski resort and putting the lifts at the bottom of the mountain, but not connecting them to the slopes.
The beachfront itself tells the same story. Daniel mentioned a couple of overpriced stores by the beach. That's the commercial strip. It's not integrated into the urban fabric. It's a destination you drive to, park at, consume, and leave. There's no neighborhood that naturally spills onto the beach. No streets that terminate at the water with a view corridor. The beach is an edge condition, not a heart.
Compare that to Tel Aviv's beachfront. The city grid runs right up to the sand. Streets end at the promenade. Hotels and apartments face the water. The beach is woven into the daily life of the neighborhoods behind it. You can walk from your apartment to the sand in 5 minutes without crossing a highway.
Or look at what's happening in some Turkish coastal towns where new development is required to follow traditional street sections and material codes. It was a planning decision that paid dividends for a century.
Tel Aviv works despite being a planned city because the plan was good.
The early Zionists were building a new society, and they wanted a visual break from the old, from the shtetl, from the Arab village, from European urban forms they associated with ghettoization. The modernist tower in a park model represented progress, hygiene, the future. The Bauhaus influence on Tel Aviv is the most famous expression of this, but the same impulse shaped the development towns.
Framework, not straitjacket. That's the phrase.
That's what's missing in Ashdod and Modian. The plan was the straitjacket. Every building is a variation on the same theme, and the theme wasn't very good to begin with.
Is this fixable? Can you take an Ashdod and retrofit it into something that feels like a place?
The system produces Ashdod not because anyone is incompetent, but because the incentives, the ideology, and the institutional structures all point in the same direction. The space between buildings became rooms rather than leftovers.
That's the key. You don't need to tear everything down. You need to fix the space between.
There are streets in Modian where the Safdie vision actually survived, where the terraces work, where the public space is well proportioned. The problem is that these are exceptions, not the rule. The overall impression, especially from a car, is of undifferentiated sprawl.
That's important, especially from a car. The experience of a city is fundamentally shaped by how you move through it.
There's research on this. Streets with a continuous tree canopy see average vehicle speeds drop by 8 to 10 kilometers per hour, even without any other traffic calming. The trees create what psychologists call perceptual narrowing. The driver feels the space is smaller, so they naturally slow down.
The pedestrian feels protected. The tree trunk creates a vertical barrier between them and the cars. It's psychological as much as physical.
The transitions between public and private are gradual, stoop, threshold, interior, and you experience them sequentially on foot. In Ashdod, the city is legible primarily from a car. Building facades are seen from a distance, at speed. Signage is large and high. The transition is binary. You're either in your car or you're in a building. There's no in-between.
The death of the threshold.
That's actually a term in architecture, transitional space. And it's one of the things that traditional Mediterranean urbanism does brilliantly.
All right, let's zoom out. Daniel's prompt is really about a feeling. The feeling of being let down by a place that should be more than it is. And he's asking what creates the opposite feeling. The mesmerizing, relaxing, peaceful experience of a Greek village or a Spanish hill town. Can we name the ingredients?
Let's do it. Number 1. Enclosure. The street feels like an outdoor room with defined walls on both sides. The buildings meet the street, and the height-to-width ratio is roughly 1-to-1 or 1-to-2. That creates a sense of shelter.
Number 2. Shade and climate comfort. The street is designed for the climate. Materials, orientation, vegetation, and proportions all work together to create a microclimate that's pleasant to be in. You're not fighting the environment, you're working with it.
The feeling that you're in a place that doesn't care about you. Your eyes are constantly engaged without being overwhelmed.
Number 4. The absence of cars, or at least their subordination. In a Greek village, the car is a guest, not the master. Streets are narrow enough that cars move slowly and carefully. The pedestrian has priority by default.
A housing storage facility is an environment that supports the efficient warehousing of human beings between work and sleep.
That's the line of the episode. Housing storage facility. It's the opposite of a single developer's catalog.
Number 7. Social legibility. The village is small enough that you recognize people. The shopkeeper knows your name. There's a web of social relationships embedded in the physical space. The place feels inhabited, not just occupied.
The plaza at sunset, the evening paseo, the outdoor dining, the street life that continues late into the night. These are cultural practices, but they're enabled by a physical environment that supports them.
That's the list. And you can see instantly why Ashdod fails on every single one.
Every single one. No enclosure, no climate comfort at street level, zero visual complexity. Cars dominate, uses are separated, buildings are identical, social legibility is non-existent, and nature is either absent or reduced to a scorched lawn between parking lots.
None of this is mysterious. Jan Gehl has been writing about this for 50 years. Jane Jacobs wrote about it 60 years ago. The knowledge is there. The problem isn't a lack of knowledge. There's actual research on this. Studies of walkability consistently find that the built environment is a stronger predictor of walking behavior than climate or culture. People walk when walking is pleasant and useful.
Say more about the system.
The Israeli planning system has several structural features that produce these outcomes. First, the land is almost entirely state-owned. The Israel Land Authority controls something like 93% of the land. Development happens through a tender process where the state releases land to developers according to a master plan. The developer who wins the tender is the one who offers the most money, not the best urban design.
Narrow streets for shade, thick walls for thermal mass, courtyards for ventilation, white surfaces to reflect sunlight. These are climate adaptations.
The price is driven by the maximum number of housing units the zoning allows. So the incentive for the developer is to max out the zoning envelope, build the cheapest possible structure that meets code, and sell the units as quickly as possible. The glass tower in the desert is a climate crime pretending to be modernity. You're absolutely right. And I think that's the most important corrective to offer here. The charming Mediterranean village isn't a quaint aesthetic preference.
The municipality, Ashdod in this case, what's their role?
The municipality approves the plans and collects the betterment taxes. They have an interest in more development because it expands the tax base. But they're not equipped to demand high-quality urban design. The planning departments are understaffed, the design review process is minimal, and the political pressure is to approve, approve, approve.
The developer maximizes units, the city maximizes tax revenue, and the resident gets a living environment that nobody optimized for.
The courtyard, the arcade, the street width, the building height, the relationship of public to private. These patterns aren't arbitrary aesthetic choices. They're tried and tested solutions to the problem of how humans live together in a particular climate and culture.
In a functioning market, developers would compete on quality. If people hated living in soulless towers, they wouldn't buy them, and developers would build something better. But that doesn't happen here.
Because the housing market in Israel is so supply-constrained that people will buy anything. When there's a structural shortage of hundreds of thousands of units, quality goes out the window. And this connects back to something Hannah has apparently been teaching Daniel, that architecture is a functional discipline.
It's the architectural equivalent of You eat what you're given and be grateful.
When you start asking those questions, the charm of the Greek village stops being mysterious and starts being legible. The quality conversation barely exists in the political sphere. It's treated as a luxury, something for rich neighborhoods.
The Greek villages Daniel is comparing to weren't rich. They were fishing villages. They were poor. The beauty wasn't a luxury add-on. It was inherent in the way they were built.
Material coherence. The buildings speak the same visual language. Incremental variation. There's complexity and surprise, not repetition. Pedestrian scale. The environment is legible at walking speed. Transitional space. Thresholds, stoops, arcades that blur public and private. And all of this is supported by a climate-adapted design language that makes being outside pleasant rather than punishing.
What's missing in Ashdod is all of it. Not one thing. All of it. The absence is total.
The totality is what makes it unnerving. If a city had wide streets but great mixed use, it might still feel alive. If it had uniform architecture but vibrant street life, it might still feel charming.
There's a deeper question here that Daniel is circling around. When a city has over 200,000 people, shouldn't it develop a culture organically? Doesn't density force some kind of urban life to emerge, even if the physical form fights it?
That's the hope, and it's partially true. Ashdod does have culture. It has a Russian-speaking community that brought theaters and literary circles. It has a Moroccan Jewish community with deep traditions. There are, but they tend to be in similar development contexts. The Chinese ghost cities that got built during the property boom, massive districts of identical towers with no street life. Some American Sunbelt sprawl, Phoenix, parts of Houston, where the car is the only way to move, and the public realm has been completely privatized into malls and gated communities.
Because the streets don't invite it.
A Moroccan Jewish celebration needs a public square. A Russian literary reading needs a sidewalk cafe. An Ethiopian market needs a street where vendors can set up stalls. If the city doesn't provide those spaces, the culture goes indoors. The specific Israeli twist is the combination of centralized land ownership, developer oligopoly, the development town legacy, and the ideological preference for modernism as a break with the past. It's a perfect storm.
Is there any sign of change? Are Israeli planners waking up to this?
There's been a growing critique of the tower in a park, model in Israeli planning schools. Some municipalities are experimenting with form-based codes that regulate building-street relationships rather than just land use. There are a few recent projects, the new neighborhoods in Harish, some parts of the Tel Aviv Southern Expansion, that are trying to create actual streets with ground-floor commercial and continuous building lines.
The soullessness Daniel feels is a real functional deficit. It's not a matter of taste. It's not some people like modern and some people like traditional. It's that the city is failing to do what cities exist to do, bring people together in public space.
A city is a social technology. It's a machine for turning proximity into community. When the machine is broken, you get proximity without community. 200,000 people living near each other but not with each other. That's where we are. The knowledge exists. The precedent exists. The principles are well understood.
The charming places have community baked into the very shape of them. The plaza isn't an afterthought. It's the reason the village exists in the first place. The buildings are arranged around it. The streets lead to it. Life naturally gathers there.
There's a wonderful term in Spanish urbanism, el espacio de todos, the space of everyone. It refers to the public spaces that belong to no one and therefore belong to everyone. The plaza, the promenade, the market street. Here's a thought that gives me some hope. The charm of those Greek and Spanish villages wasn't created by policy.
The parking lot is the anti-plaza. It's public space surrendered to private machines. You can't linger in a parking lot. You can't set up a market stall in a parking space. You can't have a conversation in the middle of a parking aisle without being in the way. It's space technically designated as public, but functionally made unusable for public life.
That's not an accident. Israeli planning codes mandate minimum parking requirements for every building. A residential tower needs a certain number of parking spaces per unit. The result is that every building is surrounded by parking. The Barcelona model. Strong rules about the public realm, street width, building height, block size, ground floor use, and maximum freedom within the private plots. That's the sweet spot.
I want to end on something more philosophical. The prompt uses the word soulless several times, and I think it's worth sitting with that word. A soul isn't a physical property.
It's one of the most destructive policies in urban planning history, and it's still on the books in most Israeli cities. The assumption is that everyone will drive, so we must provide parking. But providing parking induces driving. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Bill for cars, and you get cars. Bill for people, and you get people.
There's a fascinating counterexample. Freiburg in Germany. After the war, they rebuilt their destroyed medieval center not as a modernist clean slate, but following the original medieval street pattern. Narrow streets, small plazas, mixed use. They added a tram system and restricted cars. The result is one of the most livable cities in Europe.
It was built for units, for cars, for throughput. You're an afterthought. They just rarely are, because the system is optimized for something else.
What would it take to change the system? If you were appointed urban planning czar of Israel tomorrow, what's your first move?
Ashdod and Modi'in Red is uncaring not because anyone was malicious, but because the system optimized care out of the equation. The developers were responding rationally to incentives. The planners were responding rationally to mandates. The result is a rational product that fails at the human level. Establish a street design manual based on human scale principles. Maximum street widths for different contexts. Mandatory street trees. Minimum sidewalk widths. Requirements for active frontages on designated main streets. Make it so the default street is pleasant to walk on, and you need a special permit to build something worse.
Day 4, you get fired because the developers and the parking lobby and the traffic engineers all revolt at once.
Oh, I'd be out by lunch on day 1. But the point stands, the changes needed are not technically difficult, they're politically difficult. Every part of the current system has a constituency that benefits from it. That's the hope. Naming the problem is the first step.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
If you tell someone who just spent their life savings on a car-dependent suburban apartment that the future is walkable urbanism, they don't hear better quality of life. They hear my property value will drop and my commute will get worse. The transition is hard, and you can't dismiss those fears.
The pragmatic path is incremental. Street trees first, then a pilot neighborhood, where you allow mixed use and narrow the streets. Show people what it looks like. Let them experience it. Build demand for more.
That's the only way it works. You can't impose urbanism from above. You have to demonstrate it. Create one great street, one great plaza, one great neighborhood, and let people see what they're missing. The demand will follow.
Here's the open question I'm left with. We've diagnosed the problem, but what's the first domino?
It does matter. This isn't a niche aesthetic concern. The design of our cities shapes our health, our social connections, our carbon emissions, our resilience to climate change, our daily happiness. Break up the land tenders. Require that any new development above a certain size reserve at least 30% of lots for small builders and individuals.
The fact that Klonekilde feels alive is not a small thing either. It's proof that the alternative is real and achievable.
It's been achieved in 1,000 places, in 12 climates, across centuries of trial and error. The knowledge is there. The question is whether we have the will to use it.
That's the open question, and I think it's where we should leave it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1780s, traders in what is now South Sudan described a deep blue pigment made from grinding a specific iron-rich clay found at the edge of a seasonal ice cave. When mixed with gum arabic, the pigment produced a blue so intense it was reserved for ceremonial body painting and was said to be visible from half a mile away.
Visible from half a mile away. That's less body paint and more emergency signaling.
I have so many questions about an ice cave in South Sudan. That was a lot to process.
This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for keeping the show running and apparently for unearthing deep-cut pigment trivia from the 1780s. If you enjoyed this episode, the best way to support us is to leave a review wherever you listen. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.